What is Begotten? By Alistar. Read by Rhea 314. Fandom the Eagle, pairing Marcus Eska. Rating teen and up audiences, no archive warning supply. Chapter 1. And there is a story, said she, that people in love are those who are seeking their other half. But my story tells that love is not for a half, nor indeed the whole. Since men are willing to cut off their own hands and feet, if these seem to them to be faulty. Plato, Symposium. A few days before Saturnalia, Marcus has a dream that he's being led in chains to a dark room crowded with unwashed bodies. The shackles around his wrists are unlocked by rough hands, and then he's shoved into the dimness, colliding with the shoulder of another man who growls. Before the large wooden door swings shut, the jailer says in Latin, strange that Marcus should remember that distinctly, the man speaking Latin. Slaves who can't suck cock can feed lions. It's the freshness of that dream, perhaps, that inspires the strange fire inside Marcus when he and his uncle attend the circus games and he sees the young slave fall. Whatever it is, he watches the gladiator press the sword tip against the slave's sternum with a tight knot of pain in his own chest, and a protective rage comes over him. Suddenly everyone in the arena with thumbs pointed downward is his enemy. He rails against them, forgetting himself, forgetting his ruined leg, feeling all that dream man's banked anger and snarling resentment. 3 days later, Uncle Aquila buys the slave for Marcus. His name is Eska. He speaks Latin with a Brythonic accent, softening and lengthening the vowels and clipping the consonants. He stares at Marcus from deep-set eyes with unequivocal grimness. He swears a blood oath to Marcus for saving his life, but there's no gratitude in his face, only resolve. Marcus nods his assent, and then Eska takes a station near the wall, hands clasped in front of him, looking into the middle distance. Marcus does not know what to do with a slave. Stephanos and Sostica have hovered over him since he came to live in Kaleva, so eager to help that Marcus never has to ask for anything. His aunt in Rome had slaves, but Marcus had been so alienated in that household that he'd never felt he had the authority or presence to ask them for anything either. But Uncle Aquila is right, that Stephanos can't attend to both his uncle and Marcus. And right also with the unspoken assertion that Marcus can no longer take care of himself. After nearly an hour of Eska's presence pricking like a needle in Marcus's attention, Marcus looks up to see Eska staring at his injured thigh. What is it? He snaps. Eska's gaze lifts to meet his calmly. Nothing, he says. The night before the gladiator fight, I had a dream my leg was wounded. Eska spends most of his first few days training with Stephanos. He learns where the cloths and basins are kept, what he may take from the kitchen, who to ask for in the stables. He is told sternly where he is to stand during meals and what foods Marcus does and doesn't like, and what foods are good for his healing, which he should eat even if he doesn't like them. He goes to market with Stephanos to meet vendors and Aquila's banker and the mason who keeps the hypocaust. At first, Stephanos insists that Eska address Marcus as Dominus, but when Marcus refuses to answer to it, he relents. Stephanos demonstrates how to wet a tuft of wool in a mash of roux and goat fat to draw out the fever in Marcus's leg, shows him how to apply the salve by dressing the injury himself while Marcus looks away, stone-faced. All told, Marcus, prideful, and Eska unused to such service, managed to go nearly a week before making direct physical contact. By the end of the sixth day, they have established a night routine that involves very little talking. Eska brings a pitcher of water from the kitchen and fills the basin that rests on Marcus's oakwood trunk. Marcus murmurs a thanks, to which Eska does not reply, then pulls off his tunic and throws it into a basket that Eska will take away in the morning. He washes his face and under his arms, leaning heavily with a hip against the trunk to keep the weight off his leg. Afterwards, Esko will hand Marcus a towel. It is nearly comfortable. Neither of them wants to talk to the other. At the end of the sixth day, however, Marcus stumbles on his way to bed. He's just thrown his soiled towel into the basket for Esko and turned too quickly toward the bed when his leg, overworked from nearly a week of Marcus's sullen displays of independence, bows cruelly beneath him. Esko darts forward to catch him with a grip on Marcus's bare arm, and both men gasp. They tumble to the floor together, muscles contracting, burning from the inside. Esko rolls away, panting like a hound. Marcus looks at him, eyes wide, hand white-knuckled on the corner of the oakwood trunk. "What did you do?" he asks. Esko shakes his head. "Did you..." Marcus looks at his arm where Esko touched him. "You burned me." "No," Esko says slowly. He pushes himself up, rubbing the hand he'd laid on Marcus's arm. He raises his eyes to Marcus, jaw tight. "No, it burns everywhere." It's true. The place where Esko touched him burns like a brand, but the sensation is echoed in the skin all over his body, except his leg, where the sharp throb of his wound drowns out all else. "You poisoned me." "No," Esko says again. He reaches his hand out, and Marcus glares to keep him at bay, though he knows he is defenseless in this position, crumpled on the floor over his wounded leg, a mysterious poison coursing through his system. Esko turns his hand palm upward, fingers curling towards himself, placating. He approaches like that, scooting across the floor. Then he lowers his hand, softly, knuckle first, to the ankle of Marcus's uninjured leg. Immediately, relief washes through Marcus like water, and all his breath leaves him in a huff. Eska's eyes drop closed, mouth parting. "What witchcraft is this?" Marcus says. He watches Eska's hand on his leg turn, sliding his palm up Marcus's calf, spreading his fingers in a loose grip. Again, Esko shakes his head, letting out a long breath. "It is not of my doing." They sit together on the floor for a while, not talking. Finally, Esko says, "I'll help you to bed." He pulls his hand back, and the burning doesn't return, but the feeling of water vanishes, leaving only a sense of abandoned space. He climbs to his feet, and Marcus does the same, one hand on the oakwood trunk and the other clenched on Eska's arm. The place where their skin touches feels deliciously cool, a bead of rainwater on sun-baked mud. He releases Eska's arm as soon as he can to collapse into bed. Esko douses the lamp, quickly undresses, and drops heavily onto the wool-stuffed mattress next to the door. "Good night," Marcus says, because that is part of their routine. "Good night," Esko says. Marcus lies awake for a long time, thoughts turning. The blood oath, he thinks. Eska's blood oath did something to them, a Breton magic. Tomorrow he can ask his uncle for a lamb to take to the temple in the North City Wall. He can't explain why he needs a sacrifice, of course. If a slave were implicated in witchcraft, he would be sent away at best, or more likely executed. The thought fills Marcus with horror. He could tell his uncle that the sacrifice was for his healing, or his family's honor. But to take a lamb under false pretenses would be akin to stealing, and besides being dishonorable, surely such a tribute would have no good effects. Marcus's mind shifts restlessly while the moon climbs higher. And eventually a shaft of moonlight from the lattice veranda door catches in the white of Eska's eyes. "You're awake," Marcus says lowly. He watches Eska's eyes move toward him in the dimness. "Yes," Esko says after a long moment. "My leg pains me." The next morning, Marcus sends Esko for bread and wine and cedar resin, and he lays up an offering on the altar in his room. He runs the blade of Eska's father's dagger through the column of scented smoke, dips the tip into the shallow pool of wine, and then gives it to Esko. Esko takes the dagger in his hand, looking expressionlessly down at the blade. It occurs to Marcus to belatedly wonder if he has desecrated it. "To undo the magic," Marcus says, "that we felt last night. I am giving it back to you." But Esco only places his father's dagger on the trunk next to Marcus's goat salve. "The dagger has a human oath in it. A life binding is made by the gods." Marcus frowns. "A life binding?" "Anamkara," Esca says. "I don't know the word for it in your tongue. Life. The life inside you. The ghost." He looks flatly at Marcus. "We are ghost companions." It's an unfamiliar phrase, but as Marcus stares at him, Esca huffs a breath. His hand lifts and hovers a moment, again palm up, before he sets the backs of his fingers against Marcus's arm. His brows draw together, and suddenly Marcus senses an image, like a long-buried memory, a diaphanous form made of stories Esca heard around a hearth fire, enraptured, later filled in with his own strange relief when he touched Marcus a second time. An image of two men, or two women, or a woman and a man, fighting next to each other, fierce and unshakably loyal, sharing unspoken thoughts, hearts beating in time with each other. Marcus knows the word for that well enough. It is not a thing to be made or broken during one's life. Eska's face is grim. "But we have different gods," Marcus says. The thought of Mithras leaving Marcus to the whims of a blue-skinned barbarian god is unsettling. Whatever his father's feelings, Marcus is surely not that unvalued, not that abandoned. He unseats Eska's hand with a small shake of his arm. Eska turns with a faint snort to gather the wine cup and wooden bread plate to return them to the kitchen. Perhaps it's only the Romans who speak nothing but Latin. After that, life continues, made partly of habit, partly of secrecy, partly of the strange commerce of sensation between them, and their unspoken agreement to deal with that commerce as obliquely as possible. For all that Marcus wishes it were otherwise, he is not capable of getting around much by himself, so they can't avoid physical contact. Their fingers brush as they pass objects between them, and Marcus's arm presses against Eska's bare neck when Eska takes his weight as they walk. Eska applies the salve to Marcus's injured leg, as he was shown, but when the dressing is finished, he sits for a long moment with his palm pressed flat over Marcus's thigh, a touch that cools the fever in the wound and warms everything else, while Marcus tries to fill his mind with noise, memorized equations and historical dates, no military secrets, none of his uncle's financials, even as his limbs grow heavy with a feeling of peace. Marcus does not welcome a lingering touch at any other time. One day, near the beginning, he catches a brief grimace on Eska's face as Eska withdraws his hand. "It pains you to touch me," Marcus says, but Eska shakes his head. "It feels to me as it feels to you." He glances at Marcus. "It is a comfort to you," he adds, "but there is a question in it." Marcus nods tersely. Beyond that, they never speak of it. When his leg pains him overmuch, or his heart sickness from lying abed and considering his future is too great, or when he finds himself yearning for Eska's touch, Marcus sends Eska on pointless errands. Fetch some wine, or help her shoe the horses, or check the market for plums. Some days he gives Eska leave to hunt, just to get him away from the villa, and on those days there is a wild restlessness clawing at Marcus's skin. One day, when Eska has been away for several hours, Marcus is at a table leaned over one of his uncle's books, when he feels a pulse of something, of intent, and looks up to realize the fog of arousal that is curled up around him unnoticed. He closes his book and clasps his hands in the cover. He well knows what is happening. He breathes heavily at the thought of it. Eska is a beauty, proud and well-made. He can imagine Eska's solemn brow pinched, the pink bow of his mouth parting as he strokes himself, his head tossing against the tree bark, the sunlight through the winter canopy catching on the gold of his beard. For a moment, Marcus sees his own face, staring meditatively out of the veranda door, the strong cords of his neck limned in light. He lets loose a heavy breath as Eska's release washes through him, shivering like a fever breaking. One of Uncle Aquila's friends, the Praetor Quintus Avidus Atta, visits the villa at Kaleva with his son, Lucius Messias. Lucius is cheerful and polite, a few years younger than Marcus, and he asks questions about the Second Legion at Isca Domnoniorum, not Marcus's injury or stillborn military career, but the valor of Marcus and his men, with such enthusiasm that Marcus finds himself answering in kind. He remembers himself a love for talk of military routines, training exercises, fortifications, the ribald humor of soldiers. Marcus has not been good company of late, particularly to his uncle's Roman friends, who remind Marcus how ruined he is. But he finds himself enjoying the dinner with Lucius and his father. Eska moves around them, filling cups and gathering dishes, his presence a pleasant fixture on the edge of Marcus's awareness, like the smell of wild cherry logs burning on a brazier hearth. "Your slave is Brigantes," Lucius says, after Eska has scooped up several bowls of fish bones and denuded grape stems and carried them away. He points to his own arm. He has the markings. Quintus Avidus nods. "Probably taken in the last rebellion, a few years ago, near Calatum." "Yes," Uncle Aquila says. 7 years now, isn't that right, Marcus?" Marcus nods. He knew the history before he came to Britain, and now he knows it better, has seen it in his mind, in nightmares that shook him awake and left him and Eska breathing hard together in the same room, feet away from each other, mutually unacknowledged. "I imagine that it's difficult having a household slave who wasn't born to it," says Quintus Avidus. "Especially a young man, I would imagine, and a Briton at that." "No," Marcus says, eager to move the conversation on before Eska returns from the kitchen, but unable to explain to himself why. It isn't unreasonable to explain to visitors in front of Eska that Eska is a good slave, hard-working, strong, intelligent, obedient, all that Marcus could ask of him. Eska is all those things, and they are praises. "But now that you mention it, in Isca Domnoniorum, there was a Gaulish auxiliary who..." When Eska turns to refill their wine, Marcus is more aware of him, and aware, too, of Lucius openly watching him. Marcus doesn't need a life binding with Lucius to know what the younger man sees. A fine-featured slave with strong hands, intelligent blue-gray eyes and a soft-looking mouth, whose lowered gaze always looks only focused, driven, and not deferential. "He's well-made," Lucius says when Eska withdraws again. "You say he doesn't cause you trouble?" Marcus nods, feeling his mouth harden. "Your uncle graciously offered me and my father separate quarters. Maybe your slave could attend me tonight." Lucius asks it with the same polite guilelessness with which he asked for stories of Marcus's command. "When you're done with him?" Marcus's face heats. Lucius glances back at him when he doesn't answer. He probably assumes that Marcus's stony, downturned gaze is due to shame, because Marcus's incapacity is so great that he requires his body slave at all hours. But Eska comes in from the kitchen with nothing in his hands, concerned eyes seeking Marcus. "No," Marcus says lowly, "I am never done." He withdraws soon after that, with a stiff farewell to Quintus Avidus and an apologetic-looking Lucius. Eska helps him from the table, thin-lipped as Marcus's confused, helpless rage passes between them. They prepare for bed in silence until Eska is making ready to douse the lamp, when Marcus says, "Come here." Eska comes to stand beside the bed, and Marcus can't bring himself to take Eska's hands as he wants to, or invite him to sit on the bed. So he says, "Kneel." Eska's eyebrows draw together, but he obeys, And Marcus thinks unbidden of his dream, just before meeting Eska. The jailer saying, slaves who can't suck cock can feed lions. Marcus breathes out a long breath, and then frames Eska's jaw in his hands, leaning forward until their foreheads touch. The heat of his anger, his panic nearly, cools as they breathe together. In the connection between them, Marcus feels nothing but Eska's watchfulness and patience. The relief Eska finds in their touch, and that hard, impenetrable thing he thinks is Eska's resolve. You will not be required to service another master while I'm alive, Marcus says. And if you die? Eska murmurs. Marcus swallows. I'll talk to my uncle. He feels the briefest curl of grim amusement from Eska, something cold and sardonic, before Eska pulls away from him and says, We should sleep. Eska douses the lamp and lies down on his pallet. In the dark, Marcus's mind settles into thoughts of an ownership that has nothing to do with Marcus's legal mastery of Eska, but is at the same time complicated by it. He thinks of Eska's father's dagger, still sitting on his oakwood trunk, a further complication. Marcus can't bring himself to think the word mine, but he can't forget the look of interest on Lucius's face as he gazed at Eska, so he circles the track of his thoughts over and over, getting nowhere. Neither of them sleep. The week of Lupercalia, there is snow on the ground, but the crust of ice on the pond has begun to crack. Another of Uncle Aquila's friends, a field surgeon named Rufrius Galerius, comes to the Aquila household to reopen and repair the wound in Marcus's leg. Eska helps to make Marcus's room ready for surgery, bringing clean cloths and a basin of steaming hot water, and when there are no other preliminaries to settle, Eska gazes down at him, a terrible feedback loop of uneasiness between them. Marcus shifts his eyes to the painted ceiling. You can go. No, the surgeon says. I'm going to need the slave to hold you down. Marcus frowns. Can't my uncle do it? He knows the pain his leg has caused the other man in the night, or when Marcus steps on it wrong in an unguarded moment. Surely it will be worse if they are touching. And something else. Every night, every day, every time their eyes meet, there is a fingertip pressing at the skin that separates them, in a place that wears thinner and thinner. Marcus knows he will not have the strength to maintain the stretched thin barrier between them when his mind is swimming in pain. He is afraid of what Eska will see. Eska approaches. He sets his hands on Marcus's closed shoulders and leans into him. Put your weight on him, slave, the surgeon orders. He places the edge of his scalpel against the swollen, fevered seam of Marcus's wound. Eska shifts to press his arm lengthwise across Marcus's chest, still careful to keep the cloth of Marcus's tunic between them. Harder, the surgeon yells. Finally, Eska releases a breath and puts his palm against Marcus's forehead, bending him over fully and spreading his fingers. The familiar warmth spreads out from Eska's touch, but not enough to combat the animal panic seizing his limbs. They stare at each other, and Marcus can feel the desperation in the other man, the frantic protectiveness behind his stoic gaze. The surgeon's knife digs in, and Marcus holds Eska's eye, even as his body bows helplessly forward. Marcus feels a different kind of pressure then, more than Eska's arms holding him down, a blunt force in his mind pushing him out of his own body, shoving at him, wrapping around him. From Eska's unmoving mouth, he hears, Leave it, leave it. You look up from the shadows of the portico in the courtyard of your step-uncle's villa in Rome. There's a faint ache in your left leg. You wore it out today. You left first thing in the morning to wander the Forum Augustus and the market, listening to foreign tongues, looking over the exotic wares. But you are expected home in the evening for dinner, so now you wait, dismally, to be summoned to dine. You have never been lonelier than you were here. You thought you'd woken from that nightmare when you joined the army, but it turns out that the soldier's life of order and camaraderie was a dream, and loneliness the true life. You miss your mother. You sit on a stone bench, leaning back against Eska's chest. Eska's arms are circled loosely around you. He raises a hand to point out a lone pear tree growing against a low stone wall of the courtyard. Its branches spread beyond the wall, over large for such a cultivated space. Marcus's step-uncle will probably have it torn down and replaced with a topiary or a sculpted rosebush come winter. It has only one pear left, pale skin blushing a dark red, heavy with juice, nearly ready to drop. "Watch for it," Eska says, breath brushing your cheek, warm like a summer breeze. You know he is not speaking Latin. "It will be ready soon." Marcus wakes in his bedroom in the late afternoon sun. Eska is sitting on his pallet near the door. He looks up as Marcus opens his eyes, then rises and helps Marcus drink some water. Marcus's head carefully cradled in his hand. "Did I shame myself?" Marcus murmurs. Eska shakes his head no, gazing solemnly down at the other man, but Marcus does not believe him. In the days ahead, Marcus returns Eska's father's dagger to its place in a carved cedar box, and Eska asks no questions of it. When Marcus eats, Eska stands at his station, blank-faced, holding a jug of wine. Then he gathers the empty plates, taking them into the kitchen, where Marcus never follows. Sometimes they share dreams. Marcus learns the look of Eska's mother's face, and can tell probably better than Eska how much his eyes are like hers. Desire settles between them like mud between paving stones. They face the truth of their bond in the same way they have faced their losses. Marcus with brooding and avoidance, and Eska with stoic acceptance. "It is not a terrible thing." Eska was honest when he said the contact was not unpleasant. But the fact of the bond is a dismal confirmation of all the two men have suspected of themselves in recent months. Marcus an exile, bound to Britain, bound to the lowest caste of society, ordained by the gods as a man of the borderland, who needs to put away any hope of reclaiming his family's honor. And Eska, homeless and diminished, now only half Brigantes, claimed by Rome, invaded by Rome in every part. Even his soul. Chapter 2. By attaching himself to a person of beauty, I think, and keeping company with him, she said, he begets and procreates what he has long been pregnant with. Present and absent, he remembers him, and with him fosters what is begotten. Plato, Symposium. After the surgery, Marcus's leg gets better. Rufius Galerius spoke plainly before he left that Marcus would treat his leg gently until at least the summer if he did not want to be a cripple for the rest of his life. So much of Marcus's stubborn resistance to care melts away. A centurion, Marcus learned to hold recklessness in contempt. Eska has a vision in his mind of a young legionary who acted out of turn in a training exercise and ended up laming a horse. These distinctions are clear in Eska's mind, though no one explained to him. Warrior, soldier, centurion, legionary. By the time Marcus's wound is healed enough to bear weight, his leg has gone mostly unused for several months, so it takes work to rebuild. He walks from his bed to the veranda and stops to rest on the stone bench there. He walks from the veranda to the grove of apple trees in the west courtyard and sits on the edge of the walled pond. He walks from the apple grove to the bathhouse, where Eska helps him into the bath and massages the weakened, knotted muscle of his thigh. Marcus's foremost thoughts are of the ache in his leg, his own impatience with his recovery. But as Eska touches him, his grimace smooths out, to be replaced with meditative blankness. His cock grows hard in the water, and Eska knows they won't speak of it, but there's no hope of hiding it. It won't be like yesterday in Marcus's bed, when Marcus bundled a blanket in his lap, as though Eska, with his hands pressed to Marcus's leg, couldn't feel his arousal, as though they didn't both know it was an echo of Eska's own. And Marcus cleared his throat and said, They may need you in the stables. Listening to tales of Anam Kara in his youth, Esko was too young to have much interest in fucking, so his primary associations were with glory and might on the battlefield. As a boy, he imagined two men. The first Anam Kara story he can remember was about Cuchulainn and Laeg. Standing together in the maelstrom of battle, the spear and his charioteer in perfect harmony, driving through their field of enemies. But now he is in the reality of it, sharing a household with his Anam Kara, and the life of battle has left them both behind. In its place is protectiveness and sex, immuted colors, a fluctuating half-acknowledged warmth between a half-lamed Roman and his slave. The latter shelling beans, pouring wine, untying sandals, the former avoiding his Anam Kara's touch. Eska can't fault him, though. He has seen Marcus's memories of fighting with his step-uncle, of snapping at Stephanos, of occasionally biting his tongue when he disagreed with a commanding officer, but mostly of making his feelings known, his expressive face a clear picture of cheer or melancholy or reluctant compliance. Several times since the solstice, tears of frustration in his eyes. Eska, meanwhile, has been a slave for several years now. In his first month of captivity, he pulled himself far beneath the surface, a polished jet bead, an infertile bedrock underneath all his obeisances. He cried once, in fury and heartbreak, in apology, and then never again. It is easier for Eska to feel simple desire without risking anything of himself. Even so, Eska keeps his mind on his service to Marcus, and his desire for him, and little else. The thought of his father's memory, his father's defeat, as an artifact of Roman triumph in Marcus's mind makes Eska feel sick. But he can't summon any heat in himself against the other man. It is futile. He knows that he was made to love Marcus. It makes him feel ashamed. Just as Marcus works to obscure his stupid military secrets in the noise of his mind, as though Eska would care about them, even if Eska weren't his thrall. Eska works to put thoughts of his tribe from his mind. He thinks only in Latin. Eska learns the Latin word by accident, from Stephanos of all people. Soulmate. News has come to the villa that a Haruspex, who can apparently read the future in the intestines of sacrificed sheep, is visiting one of the temples in Kaleva. You should go, Uncle Aquila says to Marcus over dinner, eyes thoughtful. It may ease your mind. Marcus's mouth twists wryly, or weigh it further. The next day, a man from the market delivers several bags of olives to the villa, and Stephanos sets about teaching Eska how to press them into oil. They and Sastika and Nesta, another of the kitchen slaves, sit around a loose circle, surrounded by wicker baskets of oily meat of the olive and metal basins for the pits. Sastika pries open an olive, spreading its flesh with her thumbs, and leans over to Nesta with a smile. Tell your fortune, young miss. Nesta laughs. You know, my mother's mistress took her to a Haruspex once, says Stephanos. Stephanos is a severe man and not one for humor or play in the household, disapproving of Eska in general, but he is strangely fond of stories, especially stories about love and devotion and self-sacrifice. It was unheard of for a mistress to provide for her slave so. She was a kind woman, a lady of generosity and impeccable virtue. He tells a story about his mother's owner buying her a bracelet after seeing his mother admire it in the market. Stephanos tends to rhapsodics when speaking of the goodness of his owners and his parents' owners. Then, the Haruspex told her she had a soulmate with yellow hair. I don't know that word, Eska says, sliding the basket of olive meat away from Sostica's feet and replacing it with an empty one. Stephanos glances over with a pleased smile. Long ago, he explains, the humans had four arms and four legs, and one head with two faces. But the gods feared their strength, and so Zeus split them with lightning bolts, and thus created humans as they are now. One face, two arms, two legs, wandering the earth in search of their other half. Eska leans over his bowl of olives as he listens, mouth in a grim line. Split by a strange god, one body, one mind, one single country of origin. When Stefanos finishes, Eska hands him a new bowl of unpitted olives. "Did your mother's soulmate turn out to have yellow hair?" he asks. Stefanos' smile dims. He glances self-consciously at the other slaves. "Well, her mistress rarely traveled." As Marcus grows stronger, he becomes more mobile, and after a long season spent abed, he spends as much time as he can outside. The olive hues of his skin come to full color, ruddy in the cold, and he puts away his pale linen tunics in exchange for braque and tunics made of British wool, dyed with madder root and woad. To Eska, he is inexpressibly handsome, but he can see in Marcus's mind that the braque feel womanish to him. He is shy in front of Stefanos and his uncle for it, but Marcus's self-consciousness fades quickly in the brisk sunshine of the British spring. He relies on Eska less and less, but strangely, that eases things between them. They rarely touch, and their restlessness grows, but it's easier for them to be near each other. Close to Beltane, Marcus travels with his uncle by ox-cart to Londinium, a full day's ride to the east, to pass a week-long Roman spring festival with his uncle's friends. "Maybe next year you and I can go," Marcus says as he packs, but his face is troubled. At first, Eska's dreams that week are ornate and strange, full of color, alive with Marcus's curiosity and general love of fellowship. But 3 days in, Eska is in the stables, currying the dappled mare, and a stab of loneliness hits him so hard that he fumbles his brush, jolting back against the stall and spooking the horse. Eska sets a soothing hand on her flank, breathing deeply. Half a week later, Marcus returns silently to the house in his ox cart. He meets Eska's eyes as Stefanos orders Eska to help unload his master's things, but they do not exchange words. Eska trails behind Marcus with a satchel and a small chest, then unloads them next to Marcus's oakwood trunk. He turns to see Marcus lowering himself to Eska's pallet, mindful of his knee. Then Marcus looks up at him, expression lost. Eska stoops in front of him, pulling Marcus's face to tuck against his neck, fingers clenching over hard in Marcus's hair, punishingly, painfully tight, while Marcus shakes in his arms like a newborn colt. By midsummer, Marcus is well enough to hold his thighs around the flank of a horse. And after weeks of taking rides around the city walls, ambling along the riverside and back, Marcus wants to go hunting. Outside the south gate, they cross a field toward the forest, and Marcus urges his gelding into a full run, toward nothing, only to circle back and meet Eska near the tree line, grinning, face red from the wind. Marcus calms his gelding with a gentle hand as he catches his breath. He turns back to look at the city walls, the pasture land to the south, the giant, cloudless sky above them. He is a beauty, strong and broad as his horse, graceful even after a year of misuse. Pleasure and exhilaration flow from him in waves. In another life, he would have been an honored warrior, a shield brother, an undisputed blessing. Instead, he finds himself here, a man who considers himself somehow shamed despite his resilience and valor, caught up in the net of Eska's life, sometimes playful as a boy, sometimes tender as a woman. Something like gratitude, only more jagged, breaks open inside Eska's chest. Marcus whips his head around to meet Eska's eyes, a soft, stunned look on his face. On the morning of Lunastal, Eska takes a fever. He empties his stomach on the grass next to the villa's external walls and then slumps, grinding his head against the painted stone. His thoughts swim, and he doesn't know what Marcus hears or feels from him. He never knows, but Marcus finds him like that within the hour. "Eska," he says, kneeling next to him. He wipes Eska's mouth with the corner of his cloak. Together they make it back to Marcus's room, Eska taking as much of his own weight as he can on trembling legs. Marcus walks them past Eska's pallet to the bed. "No," Eska says, keenly aware of the dirt and grass stuck to his palms, the bile sitting low in his throat. "Shh," Marcus says, and bends to take off Eska's sandals. He pushes Eska back against the pillow, then leaves to move around the room. Eska's eyes slide closed, but he hears the sound of pouring water, and then Marcus is back, with a hand in the back of his head, lifting him to drink. Eska huffs against the lip of the cup, choking a little, and Marcus moves his thumb to the bare skin of Eska's ear, settling him, filling Eska with quiet as he takes a cautious sip. Then Marcus sets him back against the pillow and cleans him with a wet cloth, his palms, his face, then folds another cool cloth across Eska's forehead. Marcus slips his other hand into the neck of Eska's tunic, just to rest it there, thumb stretched out along Eska's collarbone, fingers curling gently around the base of his neck. Eska isn't sure how long it lasts. Marcus leaves and returns a dozen times. At some point the room is dark, and Eska hears the wordless tune of a song of his youth, that his mother used to sing when her children were ill, rough in Marcus's low voice. Eska's face is wet, and he isn't sure why. "I'm tired," Eska says in his own tongue. Marcus smooths the hair off his forehead, thumb tracing the line of his eyebrow. Eska hears in his own tongue, "Then sleep." The field of your homeland stretches out in front of you, deathly quiet. You slide off the bay mare and wrap her lead around the long hitching rail that once regularly was home to 20 horses, when war parties were gathered in your father's house. The posts are made of thick oak, dug deep into the ground, and the rail will be in good repair for another 50 years at least. You can be proud of that. With a deep breath, you pull an empty sack from the saddlebag. It is hard work ahead of you, and your body aches. But before you've taken steps towards your father's house, you hear a familiar song. The deerskin of the nearest roundhouse flaps open, and Marcus steps out. His cloak is spotted with dirt and rotted hay, his face smeared with soot and chalk. He's carrying two large sacks, cradled gently in his arms. He sees you and gestures with a jut of his chin for you to join him at the log bench outside the house.
"Everything was in the grain pit, as you said," says Marcus, his somber eyes on you as you settle next to him. "No one else has been down there."
You let out a long breath of relief. They are safe. The bodies were laid to rest, and no one has pillaged them.
"The bones?"
"They're clean," he says, nodding. "They're ready."
You pull one of the sacks near you. The bones inside are dry and whole. One by one you set the remains out in the grass, your father's skull, adorned with a gold circlet, an intact finger in a bed of peat moss, for Bernas, one of the household slaves, who taught you to play dice. A lock of your mother's hair, preserved with sand. The short, brittle femur of your little brother.
"I found Niall's brooch," Marcus says, setting out a finely wrought silver brooch. Its softened edge is made of horses running, head to tail, on a track that circles around the brooch, never ending.
There is much to take back with you, and your limbs are weak with fever, but Marcus is strong and gentle next to you, laying out the bones of your family with calm reverence. You will carry the memories of your tribe with you, and he will help you.
"Also," Marcus says, from one of the sacks he pulls a wooden plate and a leather bag. He empties thick slices of pear onto the plate and hands it to you.
"I brought this for you."
"Is it Roman?" you ask.
The pear is a different shape from the pears you know from your youth, a different hue, but it's large, large enough for the two of you, the slices wet with juice. Marcus shrugs a shoulder, turning back to sift through his granary sack.
"Not anymore."
The next few months pass in a whirl of travel and adventure. More of Uncle Akula's friends come through, and within a week's time, Eska and Marcus are journeying north to put Marcus's own father to rest, in the form of a golden eagle. Before they leave, Marcus gives Eska his letter of manumission, signed by the elder Akula.
"In case something happens to me," Marcus says, turning back to the saddlebag spread out on his bed. My uncle knows my possessions are to pass to you. Eska says nothing immediately. The river of his thoughts continues to thaw and make way for Marcus every day, but he will always lean toward cautious silence. But at the end of their first day on the road, bedded down beneath a tree, Eska reaches across the small space between them to set his hand around the familiar curve of Marcus's bicep. He knows that Marcus can feel that if something happens to Marcus, nothing will matter. Eska leads Marcus to the battle site, where the United Tribes stood against the Ninth Legion 20 years ago, where Marcus's father fell, and they stand in the forest, hands clasped, quietly sharing memories between them. Images of Eska's tribe rejoicing at the news that the Roman invaders were turned back. Images of Marcus's father placing a red-crested helmet on his head, soon to march out, smiling down at his 8-year-old son. They track the eagle to the royal clan of Epidae. The extraction is difficult, but it goes smoothly. Eska pretends to be a Briton paid to escort Marcus, or Demetrius, a Greek-eyed doctor, through Caledonia. They wait for a festival that brings many clans and a handful of foreigners to the village. They make away with the eagle in the night. No one is killed. They carry the eagle all the way to Rome, where they board with Marcus's aunt and step-uncle, who largely ignore Eska but fawn over Marcus, displaying Marcus at dinner parties, telling modified, Eska can feel it, versions of stories from Marcus's childhood. When Eska feels Marcus's frame tighten with disquiet under the eyes of his countrymen, his kin, he gentles him with a press of his knuckles against Marcus's bare knee, a subtle hand on Marcus's arm. By the time they turn to Kaleva, it is the Yuletide, but Eska doesn't remember until Marcus mentions it. It's easy to lose track of the movement of the sun, the length of every day, without the static fixtures of the homestead to gauge it by. So they seek for those fixtures, Marcus in Britain, and Eska among Roman expatriates. Eska is in their room in Kaleva, mending a long tear in his cloak, when Marcus brings him a slender stalk of mistletoe, carefully held in his hand. He sits down on the bed next to Eska, and Eska looks up from his work, and they lean into each other, mouths catching. They breathe into each other while Marcus's free hand travels up Eska's jaw and around the shell of his ear, thumb stroking Eska's cheek. Eska's mending rests in his lap, and he reaches up to cut Marcus's chin, then runs the backs of his fingers down Marcus's throat, down to knot his hand in the collar of Marcus's tunic. By now, the shock of relief when they touch is worn into something comfortable and warm, but the fire still runs hot in their blood. And the relief still catches them in startlement, a breathless hope every now and then. Eska lets him go, after a moment, with a closed mouth kiss against his bottom lip. What do you have? Marcus pulls back and shows Eska the mistletoe, a fuzzy golden bough crowned with clusters of spoon-shaped leaves and berries white as snow. He looks up at Eska. It's the Yuletide. Eska raises his eyebrows. So it is. I don't... Marcus says, frowning down at the sprig. I only remember part of it. He turns the mistletoe curiously in his hand. It stays alive and golden, even as the life of the oak tree passes out of it. So it's sacred for the solstice. Eska nods. It would be blessed by a holy man, he says, thinking of the wild-eyed druid at Isca Domnoniorum, whose chariot had nearly ruined Marcus's leg, whose intercession, though, however malignantly meant, had brought Marcus to him, then given as a gift or hung in your home, as a protection through the winter. Marcus grins crookedly. Well, I'm not a holy man, but we could still hang it. Eska touches his hair, and Marcus leans into the touch. You have a story or two, Eska says, though it is a dim, shadowy shape in his mind, so it can't be too great a presence in Marcus's mind. Someone traveling in water. Marcus nods. Aeneas, the father of Rome, he wanted to visit the underworld, and the golden light from a bough of mistletoe lit his way. Well, I can believe that, Eska says, curling his fingers around the sprig in Marcus's palm, which folds around him. Light in the dark, as with life in the winter. He likes that better than the Roman understanding of soulmates. Not a body returned to its original state, to a past dwelling, but a man carrying an object of life amid death, moving forward even in darkness, growing something, a body made new through new stories. The end. Author's notes. 1. The epigraphs from Plato's Symposium are paraphrases of the Greek philosopher Diotima of Mantinea. 2. Anamkara is not really the same principle as soulmate in the modern sense, or even in line with the Greek tradition, but that's what makes it an AU, right? That is one of the things that makes it an AU. 3. Forbearance on the timeline for this, please, which is probably not realistic. Google Maps tells me that it is currently possible to walk from London to Rome in 15 days, but I have never tried it. The end. If you've enjoyed this story, please leave feedback to the author. You can do that at a link to the text to this Podfix post. Thank you for listening.